This is Central Time. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Wisconsin State Senate Committee on Natural Resources made changes last week to a bill that would create a grant program to help local governments deal with PFAS pollution. The amendments would make it tougher for the DNR to require testing and cleanup from what the bill classifies as innocent landowners. PFAS, also called forever chemicals, have been found in water supplies around Wisconsin. High exposure to the chemicals is linked to a variety of health problems, including certain cancers and infertility. We're getting an update on that legislation right now, and in just a bit, we'll find out why some of Wisconsin's toxic PFAS waste is getting shipped to a landfill in a rural, largely black community in Alabama. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about how things like firefighting foam and other PFAS-containing chemicals get disposed of, what it means for water safety? Is this an issue in your community? Do you work in a fire station or other place that has maybe some of these chemicals lying around and you're wondering what to do with them? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Danielle Kading is a WPR reporter based in Superior. Danny, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for having me on, Rob.
Can you start by telling us about the core of this bill, this idea to grant communities money to help address PFAS pollution? What is the plan for this money?
Yeah, so it would do a variety of things. One big thing, it would establish a grant program for municipalities to address PFAS, and it would also set up a grant program for people who are considered innocent landowners. So it would help municipalities and landowners test for the chemicals in their water and wastewater treatment plants or wells, and it would also help pay for projects or upgrades to some of those facilities.
For the funding part of the plan, is there a sense that there is agreement among Democrats and Republicans that at least that part of this bill is a good idea?
Absolutely. I think that everyone agrees that there should be money thrown at this issue to try and address this problem. There's disagreement over how that should be done.
And then that brings us up to some of the most recent news that you've been covering, changes that Republicans on the Senate Natural Resources Committee made to this legislation. What came out of that?
Yeah, so if you look at the initial version of the bill and then at what has changed since then, there was an attempt to expand some eligibility for grants to privately owned landfills, and lawmakers also attempted to spell out who is considered an innocent landowner that's eligible for the money that's available under the budget, and they made some tweaks that would affect the DNR's ability to pursue enforcement action against anyone that's eligible for a grant under that innocent landowner program.
Can you talk about what that means for the DNR's ability to test for PFAS chemicals in some cases?
Yeah, so, you know, as part of the bill, it would limit the DNR's ability to conduct testing. They also wouldn't be able to prevent or delay projects based on the presence of PFAS contamination unless there's substantial risk to the environment and public health or other limited exceptions. But related to the testing piece, like, they could only do that under that program if they had probable cause to believe that it would exceed state or federal standards. And Democratic State Senator Dianne Heffelbein said she couldn't support the bill for that reason because that wouldn't help when the state currently lacks groundwater standards for PFAS. And that's important because about one third of state residents have private wells that draw from groundwater. So they wouldn't be required to test in that case.
What kind of concerns did Democrats on that committee and environmental groups raise about how innocent landowner would be defined and how the DNR testing might or might not work?
Yeah, I think the bulk of the concerns regarding this innocent landowner question is, will there be people who are eligible for this money that shouldn't be? There's fear from residents and environmental advocates that corporations who potentially caused PFAS contamination wouldn't be held accountable for cleaning up that pollution, and that that cost of that cleanup would be shifted to taxpayers. And then Democrats, again, voice concerns about limitations on the DNR's authority because they don't want to tie the hands of that agency to be able to address and clean up these chemicals.
Then on the other hand, a coalition of businesses, you write, Danny, including the group Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, also opposed the amendments that changed some of the definitions here. Why were they opposed to that?
So they were opposed to the bill because it excluded manufacturers under these changes to the Innocent Landowner Grant Program. They wanted to make sure that businesses with property that's been contaminated through no fault of theirs to be eligible for those funds. And the way the bill is currently written, they say it's unclear whether businesses would be eligible for that money. So you have environmental groups saying it's too open-ended and could potentially provide public money to corporations, but then business interests say it's not specific enough to make sure that they can tap that pot of money.
There's still a long road to go with this legislation. Danny, what's next?
So the bill can now head to the full Senate for a vote, but it's not yet been scheduled as far as I'm aware, and lawmakers would have to vote on it there in the Senate before it heads to the Assembly. And if it passes there, then it would go to the governor, but Governor Evers' spokesperson hinted that it may be vetoed because they were disappointed with the legislation and how it turned out after months of working on the proposal with them.
Danny, thanks for bringing us up to date today.
Thanks for having me on, Rob.
That's Danielle Kading, WPR reporter based in Superior, with us to talk about amendments to a state bill that would create grants for dealing with PFAS contamination in communities around the state, but could limit the DNR's ability to require some testing and cleanup. Now, these PFAS chemicals are found in a lot of consumer and industrial goods, including firefighting foam. Wisconsin is currently trying to help fire departments get rid of foam, and much of it's getting shipped to a hazardous waste landfill in Alabama. The site is located in the rural, largely black community of Emel. A new story from Wisconsin Watch looks into how residents there feel about other states bringing their toxic waste there and concerns that it's a form of environmental racism. Bennett Goldstein is a reporter for America Corps, Report for America Corps member, with Wisconsin Watch, where he covers water and agriculture. He's co-author of this story. Bennett, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
And Sarah Weitz-Kotacek is a reporter for AL.com in Alabama. She's a former Mike Simonson fellow with Wisconsin Watch and WPR. Sarah, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi. Glad to be here.
Bennett, let's talk about this key chemical that's part of the PFAS story, firefighting foam. When it comes to disposing of toxic waste like this firefighting foam, what kind of options do municipalities or airports or fire departments have?
Sure. Well, there are no federal requirements for disposing of PFAS because it's not considered toxic waste. So it's really left municipalities and states on their own to determine what they're going to do with it. So for instance, in states that have designed PFAS collection programs, some have decided to incinerate their foam. But the problem with doing that is it can release PFAS back into the environment if it's not burnt at a high enough temperature. And for those very reasons, some states have decided not to do PFAS collection. Like other states, like Colorado, for instance, paid fire departments to store their foam. And then like Wisconsin, other states such as Michigan and Indiana contracted with a hazardous waste landfill to store their foam there.
Sarah, can you tell us a little bit about Emel, Alabama, where some of that foam Bennett was just talking about is going?
Yeah, so Emel is in what's called the Black Belt region of Alabama, and it's a fairly rural, remote part of the state that is called the Black Belt because of the darkness of the soil and the richness of the soil. It was sort of the heart of American slavery and cotton production and is a mostly black area, mostly very poor area. And there have been issues there that have come to attention nationally and internationally in recent years about people's sewage systems not working and sort of basic fundamental kind of infrastructure issues that we take for granted in most of the United States. So Emel is a small town in the Black Belt, kind of near the Mississippi border, sort of southern central Alabama.
And you talked to local residents in the area, Sarah, and looked at the history of the hazardous waste dump there. Can you tell us a little bit about the controversy surrounding it from when it started, before this PFAS was really a big issue?
Yeah. So like some interesting, I think, historical context is that this landfill was opened in 1977 by the son-in-law of then Governor George Wallace, who I'm sure most listeners will know as a strong segregationist governor from Alabama. And it was an era when the United States was first regulating waste disposal. And so it was sort of this burgeoning industry. And so Governor Wallace's family, had the connections to open this landfill. And Alabama also opened several landfills throughout the state. It has one of the vast, considerably more landfills than any other state. And ML landfill itself was pretty quickly like the largest landfill in the country. So it takes toxic waste, and there wasn't a lot of regulation back in the times when it opened. And a lot of local residents didn't know about it and didn't approve it. And then they kind of found out about it some years later when some local activists kind of rallied around its presence and tried to sort of shut it down. And it became a pretty big issue in Alabama, gained some, attention into the 80s. Alabama being called like the pay toilet of America. And people were, had real questions about what it meant for those materials to be buried in the ground in a mill. And one of the reasons that the landfill said that they were placing it there is that there's a specific kind of rock in that part of the ground that is not very porous and supposedly protects the groundwater beneath, which supplies drinking water for much of the region. So that was how it got to Alabama and why the infrastructure is what it is today, where there are these kinds of toxic landfills in places like the Black Belt and maybe not in places like Wisconsin.
And Bennett, what do we know about the success of this facility in preventing leaks and how safe it is to store something like this PFAS foam in a facility like that?
Sure. So hazardous waste landfills are designed to last for centuries, and they do have a lot of safety mechanisms in place that your average city landfill would not. They have two liners and leak detectors and collection and treatment systems. And when liquids run through a landfill, and which is known as leachate, at a hazardous waste facility like ML, they will collect it and then try to solidify it so they can rebury it. And like Sarah was saying, because it's located above, this area called the Selma Chalk, the landfill claims that, it's only, and studies have indicated that any water that percolates through the ground is going to take thousands of years before it reaches those aquifers. However, the track record of this landfill facility is not perfect. There have been violations documented throughout, the last, 30 or 40 years. For instance, you'll find containers in a recent inspection, investigators found that there were containers that were rusting and damaged and some were leaking. There's even a spill that investigators claimed had been uncleaned for roughly 2 years, and some of the floors that are designed to be impermeable to leakage were cracked. So, I think it, does go to show that these, systems are certainly not perfect. But at this point, there is no evidence to indicate that there has been contamination of groundwater due to the landfill or PFAS foam.
We're talking to Bennett Goldstein and Sarah Weitz-Kotacek about the reporting on PFAS chemicals being disposed of from Wisconsin by getting moved to a hazardous waste facility in rural Alabama, a small Black community there right next to the hazardous waste landfill. You can join in at 800-642-1234. You have questions about what happens to waste like this and the risks it can pose and how it makes its way from Wisconsin to Alabama? What do you think about the practice of shipping these chemicals to a rural, a largely Black community like Amel in Alabama? Is PFAS a story in your community right now? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Sarah Weitz-Kotacek and Bennett Goldstein. They're two of the authors on a new Wisconsin Watch investigation into the state's PFAS disposal program that sends thousands of gallons of toxic waste to a landfill in Alabama. You could join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. Your experiences maybe with PFAS in your community, in your workplace, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Sarah, you were talking about some of the early opposition to the hazardous waste site. In your piece, you talked to people about this recent news about Wisconsin PFAS headed there. A variety of opinions, it seems like these days, on the role, the value, the concerns about this hazardous waste facility and this waste coming from here in Wisconsin. What kind of things did you hear?
Well, I think like most of the residents I spoke with were somewhat concerned about living near this toxic waste. And they said, you know, we don't really know what we don't know. I met some guys in a restaurant who were saying they had heard that some new chemical was coming. And, you know, I doubt that they would have heard that PFAS was coming, but it sort of sounded like speculation. Whereas some people didn't really know that it was there. They were younger, maybe had grown up around it and just weren't aware. So it's been there for many decades now. And I think people feel somewhat, I think it's fair to say, resigned to it being there if they are concerned, aside from a couple of local landowners who own property next to it, and they've been kind of the most vocally opposed in public meetings, perhaps the only people who are still attending public meetings from the public about this. And I would say local leaders, like the mayor of Amell, you know, he said he was focused on his health and felt that there was really limited that he could do, and he's taking care of himself and health wise, but just felt like Amell doesn't really have the resources to test anything or see if there's a problem, and they're pretty, I guess, used to that mentality or way of life.
Bennett, I want to go back to the beginning of the story. You visited with the Jefferson Fire Department here in Wisconsin. Can you talk about what they were hoping to get rid of there? Set the scene for us.
Sure. They're, one of hundreds of departments around the state that have decided to get rid of their foam. When I was there, the company that the DNR contracted with arrived and was able to just, get out a forklift and a box truck and, physically just remove, rows of plastic pails of PFAS containing foam concentrate. And once it was loaded up, they also did a careful procedure where they would wash out the insides of the department's firefighting trucks that previously had PFAS foam inside of it. And then they would collect, the water that they use for that. And then that also would end up in a vacuum truck. And eventually, once those materials are collected, they would all go to a centralized location in Wisconsin. And then once enough had been collected, would travel down Interstate 57 all the way down to Amell.
And Sarah, this issue, you focused particularly on this one site in Alabama, but there are wider concerns that a lot of dangerous waste sites end up in low-income communities of color around the country. Can you talk about this as a wider issue?
Yeah, so we looked at a 2007 study that found that people of color make up 56% of the population in neighborhoods near hazardous waste landfills. And that gets higher at 69% when there's two or more facilities in the neighborhood. So there are a range of quality of life factors that go along with living near a hazardous waste landfill beyond whether or not the water, for example, is contaminated. There might be, the anxiety or just the eyesore, property value issues. Some people say, brings jobs to the community. Other people say it drives away other businesses. So it's a complex situation, but one that plays out in many poor communities of color in the U.S.
And Bennett, do you get a sense that in talking to, state officials and others involved in this chain that this is the end of the story? We're going to find hazardous waste facilities. That's going to end up where all the PFAS goes and that's it.
I think it's really unclear what's going to happen, at least from my perspective. I mean, the DNR, you know, did what it was thought was, you know, is good for Wisconsinites. And I mean, they're really, when it comes to PFAS, are very few options. And I mean, they were really, have spent years designing this program, trying to be responsible. And I just think that this case shows that even well-intentioned actions can have consequences. And but they have taken steps, you know, that do show increasing attention to issues of environmental justice. They hired a policy advisor last year who specifically looks at the DNR programming. And, you know, she told me that they're trying to, you know, better engage with communities that are impacted and to try to include their voices in decision making. So, you know, what that means in practice, I'm not sure. I would certainly love them to tell me. But I, you know, I think that this is a sign perhaps that these issues will be at the forefront when future state programs are designed.
That's the big question here in Wisconsin. And Sarah, at your end of the story in Alabama, what are you watching for next?
Well, we've had some discussion about whether it would be possible to maybe test some of the water in a Amel, and you know, there's not necessarily reason to think that there would be an issue, but just to get that clarified. And you know, these landfills have been in Alabama for a long time, and I don't know that there's much legislative conversation about making a change on that front. But we're interested to hear more about the community reaction to our reporting, and you know, have heard from some people about it. So I'm curious to see if it starts some kind of public conversation.
Sarah and Bennett, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bennett Goldstein is a Report for America Corps member with Wisconsin Watch, and Sarah Weitz-Kotacek is a reporter for AL.com. They talked with us about their story on the hazardous waste landfill in Alabama that takes a lot of Wisconsin's PFAS chemical waste and how residents there are feeling about it. You can find a link to the full story at WPR.org/Central Time or at WisconsinWatch.org. I'm Rob Verrett. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. The Wisconsin State Assembly passed a pair of bills last week that would effectively prohibit transgender girls and women from participating in women's sports at the high school and collegiate levels. The bill's language says athletes at the high school and college levels could only play on teams that match the gender they were assigned at birth. Governor Tony Evers has pledged to veto the bills, but the legislation has put Wisconsin in the center of a wider societal debate over the participation of transgender athletes in school sports. Our next guest has been covering transgender athletes and legislation around the country and digs into the story in a new book. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the bills in the state legislature on transgender athletes? How do you think school sports and sporting organizations should handle the participation of transgender athletes? What questions do you have? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Katie Barnes is a feature writer for ESPN who covers the intersection of sports and gender. Katie's new book is called Fair Play, How Sports Shape the Gender Debates. Katie, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
You start your book off with some terminology that'll come up in the discussion. Can you talk a little bit about what we mean when we say transgender, cisgender, and when we distinguish between gender identity and, as laws sometimes do, sex assigned at birth?
Yeah, so your sex assigned at birth is, as easy as I can sum it up, is what is designated on your birth certificate. So when a baby is born, somebody writes on a birth certificate M or F for male or female, and that's your sex assigned at birth. Your gender identity is how you internally identify yourself from a gender perspective. And sometimes your gender identity and your sex assigned at birth is in alignment, and that describes what we would call someone as cisgender, cis meaning same. Right? So it speaks to that alignment. And then someone who is transgender is someone whose gender identity does not match their sex assigned at birth, trans meaning across. So that is where transgender comes from.
Now, in your book, you write, looking at the debates over who can participate in sports, I'm going to quote here, "What began as a good faith discussion about policy and physiological differences between sexes has given way to a level of intolerance and discrimination that is simply unconscionable." And Katie, that's happened pretty much since over the time that it's taken you to report on this and write this book. How have you seen this issue change from, as you say, a good faith discussion to a hot button divisive issue?
So I think it's important to note that for a lot of folks, that, you know, the idea of transgender athletes feels like a very new question. This feels like a very new issue and something that emerged out of nowhere. And I sympathize with that perspective personally. However, for over a decade, there have been folks who've been working on policy and thinking about how policy should be applied to a variety of levels of sport when it comes to eligibility for transgender athletes. When I say transgender athletes, I do mean transgender girls, I mean transgender boys, as well as a wide range of folks who have gender expansive identities, who are non-binary, genderqueer, and who push against, you know, the binary construction of our sporting apparatus that exists, which is boys and girls, men's and women's sports, right? And so over time, you know, there was that discussion that was happening already from a policy perspective. But in the last 5 years, that issue has become increasingly politicized. And in 2020, the first law passed in Idaho, HB 500, that specifically restricted transgender girls' ability to participate in girls' sports. And then now, of course, we're up to 23 states, with Wisconsin being a state that is currently considering this, as well as Ohio. So it is something that has become quite politicized, very divisive. And, you know, speaking to the passage of Fair Play that you read, for me as a reporter, I have seen the tenor of discussion change, where, you know, the breadth of the laws is quite significant. And so when you were describing the legislation that is being considered in Wisconsin, right, you mentioned that it affected high school sports and college sports. Well, the bill that affects school sports actually does not make a distinction between high school, middle, or elementary schools. And in fact, is written to be quite broad, and it doesn't make a distinction between competitive sports at the school level or intramural and club sports. It actually goes out of its way to enumerate specifically club and intramural sports, and the college bill does the same. So the type of competition that is being discussed has really widened. It's not just about what is fair from a competitive standpoint, which is, I think, where folks started in this conversation, and has really moved to a place where all type of participation is being targeted for restriction.
Talking to Katie Barnes, author of the new book, Fair Play, How Sports Shape the Gender Debates. Republican State Representative Barbara Dietrich of Oconomowoc co-authored the bills we're talking about, told an assembly committee earlier this month that the legislation is, quote, not a matter of transphobia or hate, end quote, but about protecting women's sports. Here's a listen.
By biological males being permitted to play on women's teams because of gender identity, biological females are once again losing opportunities at titles, scholarships, and even participation. Additionally, by ignoring the scientific biological fact that males have higher bone density, greater muscle mass, and often greater height, women are being put in physical danger of greater injury in competition.
The representative there summing up what you spend many chapters of the book tackling, a couple different points there. First of all, from that quote, scientific biological fact there. What did you find when you started digging into concerns about fairness in this way, of physical fairness in sport?
Yeah, so I think the first thing that I would say is that when it comes to physiological differences between typical folks who are assigned male at birth and typical folks who are assigned female at birth, those are present. There is a performance gap after testosterone-driven puberty that we see, meaning that the fastest woman in the world is not nearly as fast as the fastest man in the world. You will not hear me dispute that. However, when it comes to the science around transgender athletes specifically and transgender athletes at a variety of ages, we know considerably less. and specifically about transgender girls. And so what I mean by that is there have been a handful of studies that have looked at really athletic output for transgender girls and women, predominantly transgender women. However, you know, athletic output is not the same as athletic performance for athletes. And also, I think what is important about this discussion is all of the things that we tend to talk about when it comes to the physiological differences in our elite athletes, like bone density and VO2 max and femur length, and you know whether or not you have double joints, which can aid flexibility in swimming, or webbed toes, et cetera, et cetera. These things that we focus on, we describe, you know, particularly elite athletes, we like to focus on them because our elite athletes are physiologically exceptional. That's the whole point. That's why they are elite athletes. When we look at the athletic participation and experiences of the rest of us who are not elite athletes, which is the overwhelming majority of athletes at the school level, 96% of them do not go on to play any level of college sports. Those athletes don't know their testosterone levels. They probably don't know their VO2 max. That is a level of scientific scrutiny that we do not place onto youth sports for a variety of reasons. And so the fact that it's being done now in the name of restrictive policy and law that is meant to be broadly restrictive, I think calls into question why such laws are being passed to begin with. I don't dispute that girls and women do not have the opportunities that they are, that should be afforded to them under the law. But that is not a question of a handful of transgender athletes in each state. It is a question of why we're not investing in girls and women's sports when they are entitled to that based on Title IX. And so to me, those are two separate questions. But from a science perspective, I think it's considerably less settled than folks would like it to be. And that's why I spent a whole chapter on it. It's very hard to sum up in a succinct soundbite, so I do apologize for that. That's kind of the nature of the beast, as it were. But I do encourage folks to read it. It's chapter 5. So it's right there for you.
And also in that clip, and you were starting to touch on it there, the idea that, okay, the cisgender girl in sports, maybe that high school hopeful going on to college, or that college competitor hoping to win national titles, is seeing unfair competition, again, from that quote from the representative, losing opportunities at titles, scholarships, and even participation. As you mentioned, we have, I think, a handful of cases in the courts and things like that to point to. How big an issue has this been?
From a systemic perspective, it's not an issue. And so what I mean by that is, yes, there are examples of transgender athletes, in specifically transgender girls, who have had a championship level success. Primarily, folks want to point to Connecticut as the example of this. And it is true, in Connecticut, from the years 2017 to 2020, there are two transgender girls who ran track at the high school level and won a number of championships. Neither of them received scholarships to compete in college. Neither of them went on to compete.
We're talking to ESPN feature writer Katie Barnes, author of the new book Fair Play, How Sports Shape the Gender Debates. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Is this an important issue to you? Do you want to see states legislate when it comes to transgender participation in sports? If so, at what level? What would you like to see happen? Do you think it's become overblown in the political landscape? If you or a loved one is transgender, love to hear how you're feeling about these issues. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Katie Barnes, feature writer for ESPN, with us today to discuss their reporting in their new book, Fair Play, How Sports Shape the Gender Debates. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think there should be different rules for transgender athletes? If so, at what levels of sports do you think they should be there? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Katie, in your book, toward the end, you, I think, somewhat reluctantly suggest your policy solutions, or at least suggestions, I think it's fair to say. And it varies depending on the level of the sport, the stakes of the sport. Can you give us an overview of how you're thinking about how we regulate transgender athletes and their participation in sports at different levels?
Yes, you would be right. It was quite reluctant. I wrote myself into a corner and just had to deal with it.
So I had to ask about it too. Yeah.
It's okay. Journalists do. They love to ask me that question. So I would say for me, I think of it at, you're right, in the different competitive levels of sport. Stakes are really important. So in school sports, meaning K through 12, I don't think any restrictions need to happen. From a scientific perspective, it's not a systemic issue. Even in when we're looking at post-puberty participation, for me, it's an issue of morally and philosophically, I simply cannot get to a place where I think it's appropriate to require minors to medicate in order to participate in school sports. That's something I can't get there for, and that's why I lay out that position. That includes, of course, club-level sports, as well as just recreational sports at all levels, including adults. There's just really no need for any kind of a restriction simply because the stakes are not there. For college, that my opinion on that extends to Division III. Again, no scholarships, no money, no stakes. Same thing with club, which is basically pay to play in college, as well as intramural level sports, which are just recreational. There's no stakes. There's really no need for restriction. At competitive Division I and Division II, there are scholarships. There is money. There are higher stakes. And so there's I would consider that to be elite athletics. And so there's a question of what types of restriction are appropriate. For me, a path to participation is the most important thing. There's no, in my opinion, scientific reason for any kind of blanket ban or restriction for transgender girls and women in the women's category at any level. Restriction is fine in terms of requiring some type of testosterone suppression. But you know, whatever those hoops are, someone needs to be able to jump through them. And then at the Olympic level, same thing. Restrictions are okay, but they need to be able to be met. A blanket restriction or ban is not appropriate to me. I think the place where this gets messiest is in club sports that are youth focused and feeders to Olympic programs. So we do send Olympians who are in their teens to compete in swimming, in gymnastics, all of those things. That is where I think this is a messy question. But I also think it's pretty clear if you're a teenager and possibly Olympic tracked. So some type of restriction would be appropriate there as well. But the specifics of those policies, that's beyond my pay grade, but that's generally what I think.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Margaret is with us in Jackson. Margaret, hello.
Hey, thank you for taking my call. So, Katie, I'm sorry, I had a little trouble listening to the whole radio show because I'm distracted over here, so you may have answered this, but if you narrow the group to the elite category that you were talking about, it still seems to me that the transgender people would have an advantage over women, transgender women, I should say, over just women because of the fact that they've had those years of the longer bones, possibly, or the bigger muscle mass. And so that doesn't seem to be, you know, a fair thing. But maybe you were just talking about that with not being able to narrow down, you know, what would be the rules.
Margaret, thanks a lot for the call. And you talk about that a little more in the book, Katie. Some international sports organizations are trying to split that and say, hey, if you've gone through puberty as a boy, basically, and developed testosterone as a boy, then you would be out in those certain sports.
Yeah, there are. So World Athletics, World Aquatics, and Cycling Federation have all passed really restrictive policy that is essentially says that if you've gone through early stage puberty, testosterone-driven puberty, you will not be eligible to compete in any elite events period ever in those sports. However, there will be an athlete someday who meets that restriction. And it should be eligible to compete. And my question is, well, would that be okay? Would she be allowed to win, to participate in the women's category? And there are some folks who would answer no to that question. I think where we are from a policy perspective is, while I do think that there are some folks who ask questions and who are seeking to understand and seeking fairness, there are also some folks who see transgender girls and women participating in women's sports at any level, at any time, as a failure of policy. And so those are kind of, that's a little sticky. In terms of the specific question that was asked around elite sports, my answer to that is it depends on a lot. Each athlete brings their own levels of physiological advantages and disadvantages, financial advantages and disadvantages to each sport that they play. And so when it comes to sports that really rely on speed, strength, and power, the amount of time post-testosterone-driven puberty and then also the effect of testosterone suppression on athletic performance is important. My point is that we don't have great data on that. I think a lot of folks think that the data is someplace where it is not. And so it's important to think about that. We also know that testosterone suppression does work to a certain degree. There are some things that cannot be undone. For example, your skeletal structure cannot be reversed. However, just because an athlete retains grip strength, or a certain level of grip strength, I should say, which one study says that that is possible, that doesn't mean that that athlete should be banned from competing in soccer, right? And so the way that we treat team sports perhaps is different than how we treat individual sports. My point is that a blanket ban, even at the elite levels, on all transgender girls and women from participating after testosterone-driven puberty in the women's category is not scientifically sound because each of these sports are different. And also, you know, athletics and sports are skills. It takes a tremendous amount of training and of access, including financial access, to develop those skills. And I think sometimes we have, when we focus on biology pretty much, you know, exclusively, we have an incomplete conversation. And my belief is that we should have a more complete one and have the courage to approach this conversation with nuance, especially when it's difficult.
Thanks for that call, Margaret. Talking to Katie Barnes, author of the new book, Fair Play, How Sports Shape the Gender Debates. Katie, moving from the physics of sports to the politics of it, you tell the story of how sort of rapidly this wave of transgender-related bills went from one state legislature to another, lawsuits and more, and caught a lot of people who had been thinking about these issues, as you said, for a long time, by surprise. Is that starting to change now, or are we starting to see more of a pushback against that?
Well, I think at this point in time, the folks who are organizing for LGBTQ equality broadly are no longer surprised by this legislation. However, it has taken a backseat to other more pressing legislation. And what I mean by that is that we know, statistically speaking, the number of transgender athletes competing in each state, including the states that have passed these laws, to be very small. So when the Utah governor vetoed their legislation, which was then overridden by the legislature, he did so, and in writing, saying that of the 75,000 high school athletes in the state, only 4 were transgender and 1 was a transgender girl. In Kentucky, there's 1 known transgender girl who was trying to play girl sports before the legislature overrode the governor's veto to then enact a restrictive law. And so we're talking about being able to count on one hand in each state the number of transgender athletes that would be affected by restrictive bills. But when it comes to healthcare, that affects all transgender youth in a state. All transgender youth need access to healthcare and to affirming care in whatever way that looks for them and their families and their doctors. And so that has become the focus of a lot of organizing efforts, even as more sports bills have continued to pass into law.
And briefly, as we wrap up, Katie, you grew up loving sports. You hope lots of kids do, especially for the younger age. I think you're approaching this from a place of let's get as many kids doing whatever sports they're willing to do as we can.
100%. Playing sports is so important and it's really fun. And I loved the Mighty Ducks growing up. And so to quote Gordon Bombay, games should be fun. And I really hope that in the coming years, we can get back to talking about sports as games and as fun opportunities for all of our kids, as opposed to focusing on how to limit certain numbers of them from being able to participate.
Katie, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Katie Barnes is a feature writer for ESPN who covers the intersection of sports and gender and the author of the book we've been talking about. It's called Fair Play, How Sports Shape the Gender Debates. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, there have been a lot of mergers in hospitals and healthcare systems around the country. And Wisconsin is no exception. Find out what's driving that trend and what it means for patients and employees. And you can get that conversation started right now. Do you work in a hospital or healthcare system that has gone through or is right now going through a merger? What does that mean, if anything, for the day-to-day job you're doing? If you're a healthcare consumer, have you seen big changes, confusing changes along the way? Then join the conversation tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Today is the 65th birthday of a classic American car. There's a good chance it's not a car you're driving right now, but if it is, I want to hear about it. As reported at History.com, Chevrolet introduced the El Camino on this day in 1958. It was like a car in front with a pickup bed in the back. This was the first car-truck hybrid sold in the U.S. It wasn't the first ever. The idea had been more common, apparently, in Australia. Chevy stopped making El Caminos in 1987. Now, this story caught my eye because one of my buddies had an El Camino when I was in high school. I'm not sure what year it was made, but it wasn't new, and I could tell because I rode in the passenger seat and the floor was rusted through. So you could see the road underneath. You had to keep your feet up off the ground, and we lived on dirt and gravel roads, so it was probably more dangerous than I thought at the time. Lucky I never got hit by flying gravel coming up from under there. If you're an El Camino fan, tell us about it. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Keep on car trucking. This is Central Time.